From MyDomain.com, this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I have a real womaneer in the studio with me, somebody who is absolutely genius and has changed my life for the better, Allie Webb. For those of you who don't know her, she is an entrepreneur, New York Times best-selling author, and the founder of Drybar. Drybar is the premier destination for blow dries and styling with 100 locations nationwide and a line of Drybar products including the Buttercup blow dryer, which I personally own, and the Triple Sec dry spray, which is their best-selling volumizer and texturizer. Allie launched her Drybar empire in Los Angeles in 2010, and it has been a massive, massive success. But you might be surprised to hear that hair wasn't Allie's original career. Nope, she actually started in fashion and PR before making the switch and becoming a hairstylist and entrepreneur. With no further ado, this is Allie Webb on Second Life. So, Allie, I always like to start at the beginning because I think that is a logical place to start.
It's a good place.
What did you study in school and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
Well, I didn't really study anything because I didn't really go to college. I mean, I kind of went, but I never even made it that far to find a major. I mean, I remember, you know, coming out of high school and my friends knowing what they wanted to do, and they were all like on their way. And I was like, how did you guys know? I really was so like curious how everybody had this like idea of what they wanted to be and what they wanted to do. I was so lost. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I really only stayed in college. I didn't go to class very often. I only stayed in college like, you know, about a year. And I was like, this is not the place I want to be. And also, and then I ended up moving to New York City and wanting to work in fashion. And that's kind of like where it all began for me. But I never went to, you know, I always loved beauty and fashion. And I always struggled with my naturally curly hair. And that was like, those were the things that like got me excited. And I didn't know how to make a career out of those things at that time.
All right. Well, tell me about your first sort of proper adult job, like I'm a grown up now sort of job.
Yeah. Well, my parents had their own business growing up. And so I think that has informed so much of my life and my decisions. And I mean, my very first job was probably like sweeping the floors in their stores. They had these like old lady schmata shops, as they called them. And they were like these little discount stores. And it was a great business. It was called Flips, named after my dad, his nickname. And my brother and I both like did whatever our parents made us do.
So what was the impetus for you deciding to move to New York? You said you were young when you did that.
Yeah. I mean, I think the first time I moved to New York, I was 18 and I didn't know anybody.
What did you think you were going to do?
I don't know. I think it was like that like wanderlust and like, you know, being naive and not thinking things through that you have when you're 18. I just was like, my parents had taken us to New York City when we were kids, like through high school, like to Broadway shows. And also like I'm experiencing with my own kids now, it was so magical to me. And I was like, you know, I grew up in South Florida, I'd never really been anywhere, but New York City was like bustling and amazing and cool. And there were such cool people and fashion and all this stuff. I just fell in love with it. And I was always just like eager to get to New York. And so after like I felt like college wasn't the right thing for me, I was like, I'm just going to move to New York and like figure it out. You know, it was hard that first time. I ended up moving back to New York again after coming back to Florida again, but it was really hard. But it was one of those like rites of passage that, you know, it's like in the movies where you just are like in New York, you're living in a crappy place, you're struggling and you don't have a good job, you're not making any money and life is hard, but so important.
But you love it.
But I loved it. I loved every
second. So then at what point, you worked for Nicole Miller too,
right?
At what point did that happen?
So the second time I moved to New York, I ended up working for Nicole Miller. My brother, my older brother, who's about 3 years older than me, was living in New York at the time. And he was working for Nicole Miller in the corporate office. And, you know, at that time, this is like 20-ish years ago, Nicole Miller was like a big fashion designer, really well known. So he was working for her. And so he got me like an interview at this Soho store, which I was like, yeah, I want to work in fashion in Soho. My brother was working at the corporate office. I was working at Nicole Miller managing a store. And it was like a great little like life we were living. And at the time, my brother, who's, you know, my business partner in Dry Bar, and he's definitely the overachiever of the family, whereas I was like the what's Allie going to do with her life? Is she going to be okay situation. My brother thought it would be cool for us to move back to South Florida and open Nicole Miller stores. So she did licensing. So we moved back to Boca Raton, where we grew up, and opened up two Nicole Miller boutiques. So I'm about, like, 20-ish now.
Whoa.
So we were like—
That's kind of— I'm sorry. I was, like, drunk biking to class when I was 20. You're opening Nicole Miller stores?
And that was surreal.
How did you know what to do?
Well, I think that was, like, because we grew up in this retail environment with our parents, I think it was definitely in our DNA, and we were like, yeah, we can do that. And we also had that entrepreneurial, like, spunk that you have to have to believe you can do crazy shit like that.
Yeah.
So
and also to be young.
And
we were like, of course I can do this. No problem.
Exactly.
Because you were fearless.
We really were. And, I mean, I can see how, in retrospect, it does seem kind of crazy. At the time, it didn't. It seemed very logical. And Michael had this idea, and I was like, yeah, great. We had always been super, super close, and I was excited. I think I was, like, a little beaten up by New York at that point. So I was like, I think I just – it sounds nice to go home.
Yeah.
And so, again, I was 20, and I had, you know, it was like a brief stint in New York. So we moved back. We opened up a store in Meisner Park, and then we opened in Miami. And it's like driving to Orange County from L.A. It's like that drive from Boca to Miami. And now I'm, like, running two stores. I'm 20-ish, and I was operating – the Nicole Millers on both of these stores. And I was like, what? And I don't even know what my brother was doing. I mean, we were fighting a lot. That actually was a really important, like, piece of our stories. I was in the stores, like, managing and hiring and, you know, dealing with inventory and just doing all the stuff you do when you run a clothing store. But, you know, and then we were fighting all the time because, you know, I think he had certain expectations of me and I had certain expectations of him, and neither one of them was being met. And so it started to get really bad. And I started to realize, this is not what I want to do with the rest of my life. Like, this is not it. And that's when I started feeling like, you know, I had been flailing around since high school and just not figuring it out yet. And that's when I decided I wanted to go to beauty school. I guess Nicole Miller was probably open about a year. And then I said to my brother I was very scared to have this conversation with him. But I was like, Mike, I think I don't want to do this anymore. And I think I want to go to beauty school. I was expecting, like, the world to explode. But he was like, I get it. I think you should do that. Like, I feel like that's always what you've loved. My parents, on the other hand, were like, you want to go to beauty school? Like, what?
But so you're 21, 22.
Yeah.
I'd like to point out that flailing around since high school means all of 3 or 4 years, not a long time.
It
and you're
felt
getting this
long.
It does at that age, I think. But you were getting all of this work experience. So then by the time you went to beauty school, you probably took it more seriously than if you had gone right after high school,
100%.
Right?
Yeah, it wasn't even, like, on my radar out of high school because I didn't – it was, like, one of those things that was maybe always in the back of my mind but just felt like – it didn't, like, seem like a, you know, logical thing for me to do. I don't know. It just didn't seem, like, practical. And I think it was after, you know, trying these other jobs, doing these other things, still, like, not having a clear path. And I remember, like, you know, sitting around with my friends when they would come home from college and, like, their breaks and them being talking about the things that they're doing. And I'm like, yeah, I still don't really know what I'm going to do. And then beauty school just started to feel more and more right. And getting out of this situation where Michael and I were, like, about to kill each other was also, you know, and my parents were freaking out because we were, like, so at odds. And then, of course, once I did actually start in beauty school, I felt like I had found my people, and I was like, oh, this is the best place ever. I loved it.
So from the get-go, beauty school felt like the right fit.
It did. Unfortunately, there wasn't, like, a Paul Mitchell or, like, an Aveda, which if I was going to beauty school today, is where I would go because they're so much more buttoned up. And this is, like, doesn't even exist anymore.
It was the Wild West.
It was the Wild, Wild West for sure. And
but you learned the stuff you needed
to
learn.
I loved the experience. I loved everything about it. I did.
So then after you finished beauty school, then at what point did you decide, okay, like, now did you think, I'm going to go work in a salon, I'm going to go work for a stylist?
Well, while I was in beauty school, I was working for I was working at a hair salon under the owner, and I was really – beauty school is kind of a means to an end, even though it's fun. You don't actually learn a lot of the skills that you need, unfortunately, to go out into the world and into a – you know, into being a professional hairdresser. So I was working for a guy in a salon who was just the greatest guy. He owned a salon. And again, it taught me so much about running a business, specifically running a hair salon, which is like, you know, I'm such a big, like, everything comes around, everything happens for a reason. And that knowledge I got from just really being his assistant. And I did everything. I shampooed all his clients. I swept the floor. I took care of everything. And not only that, I listened to so many of the conversations he had with the other stylists in the shop. So, and I wasn't particularly paying attention to them, but I just absorbed it all. And that was such a great education. And I worked for him for a couple of years while I was in beauty school. And then when I was out of beauty school, I was on the floor doing hair. And I was, like, working in Boca doing hair, but was like, this is not it either. Like, this is not enough. Like, I wanted more, which I think is kind of the theme of my life, is like there's always something more, you know, like, to keep pursuing. And so I wanted to move back to New York City. Now I had my cosmetology license, I had experience, I was going to go back to New York, and I was going to do like editorial and fashion shows. That was the next level.
How did that go?
Well, not that great. So I was like, I moved, so I was like, packed your stuff. Yeah, I was like, I had a like serious boyfriend who was another hairstylist in the salon at the time. And I remember being like, I got to break this off. I got to just go. And I, you know, really just made the decision. I'm going to move. John, my boss at the time, was very supportive of it. And there was another hairdresser in New York, John Sahag, who's a very famous hairdresser at the time.
Very famous.
Yeah. I mean, he was like the shit. And I was like, yes, this is the only guy I'm going to work for. So I literally moved back to New York. I think I moved in with, like, my gay best friend, Alan. I remember walking in the salon. I don't remember how I actually got the job interview, but I remember walking in the salon, and John Sahag was, like, always at the first chair, and you could kind of see everything when you walked in. And I don't know if you ever went there, but it's, like, very, very chill and zen.
Yes.
Totally opposite of Dry Bar.
Yes.
And he is his, like, big two greyhounds laying around him, and it was like the thing. And I remember walking in, I was wearing like black leather pants, and I was like, I gotta really impress these people, you know, and be cool. And so I walked in, and I remember locking eyes with him and being like, I wanna work here so bad. And I got hired as an assistant. It wasn't like, you know.
But hey,
it was great. And I learned, again, so much. So I kind of went back to being an assistant, which I didn't care about. I was just happy to get the job in this amazing place with this guy who's such a visionary. And he liked me. I mean, he liked me from the get-go. And I enjoyed that relationship so much. But I was like, literally, I mean, talk about a humbling experience. I was like the person who walked his greyhounds on like Fifth Avenue. Yeah. And they were like horses. So you can do the math.
But I can just, yes, I can, yeah, I'm adding
it
that.
It wasn't, yeah.
But, you know, it's amazing to me that you have always had such an entrepreneurial spirit, too, where you don't come, and that's something people always ask, like, what do you look for when you're hiring? And one of the first things I say is someone with an entrepreneurial spirit, I don't ever want to hear the words, that's not my job.
Oh,
I mean,
never.
You can find me throwing things out of the refrigerator. Like, I don't care.
Right.
There's no
job too small.
Mm-mm. And you had that clearly from the get-go.
Yeah.
Which is really impressive. So you're working for John. And then what happened next?
So I was working there for about a year, and I loved it, but it was like a labor intensive hard work. And I used to, the technique, which you probably know, is like they would flat iron the hair, then the stylist cut it, then they wash it, and then an assistant blows it. And so that was me. And again, getting this great education that I didn't know I was getting. Like, so I was there for a year, and like, you know, a 20 something, now I'm like in my mid 20s, I was like, you know, I think I want to try something else.
Right.
You know, I remember sitting down with him and telling him I was leaving, because I had a friend, you probably know, Lauren Kusarak, who, talk about like serendipitous. My brother met in Miami like some random weekend and like hung out with her and became friends and whatever. And she lived in New York. And my brother's like, you should meet this girl Lauren I met. She's so cool. You would love her. I went to lunch with Lauren. She was working at Rogers & Cowan. And she was like, you should come work at Rogers & Cowan. It's so fun. I was like, okay, that sounds fun. I mean, they were like going to, like, doing such cool stuff. And I never even really knew what PR was. And I learned about it. And I was like, huh, that sounds really fun. And so I literally like walked into John's office and I was like, I think I'm going to leave. Like, I'm going to pursue something else. And he was like, I don't think you should do that. I think you're really talented at hair, and I think you should stay in this industry. And I was like, Yeah, no, I'm going to go.
And thanks for the advice.
Thanks for the advice, but no. You know, because I was like, I just felt like I didn't know if I wanted to do that.
Right.
You know, it's like, again, and I think that's like, okay, when you're in your, you know, mid-20s, that's when you're supposed to figure all this stuff out, right?
100%.
So I was doing that, and I was really excited about it. And then I became an assistant again in the music department at Rodgers and Cowan. I was working.
So for those of our listeners who don't know Rodgers and Cowan, can you explain a little bit about Rodgers, what the company is?
So Rodgers and Cowan is a big PR conglomerate that is based in New York and LA, maybe other places too. And they are like heavy hitters. They represent musicians, actors. They were representing everybody from like Paul McCartney and, you know, Janet Jackson and Jennifer Lopez. And it was like, you know,
small names.
Nobody you'd ever heard of. And then a million, I worked in the music department. There was also a fashion department and there was also actors. And I liked music and I was like, I'll work in the music department. That sounds fun.
So did you like that side of things?
Like,
I did. Also, it's got to be weird going from you've basically worked for like smaller entrepreneurs and you know, small business owners to then this massive corporate situation.
Totally. And it, I was just going to say, it's my first like office job. I'll tell you what I think I learned from that experience was like how to compose an email and how to write. And again, stuff that maybe people learn in college, but I didn't.
No, I didn't. I mean, maybe now, but
yeah, I mean, I didn't have any experience with that.
I think a lot of stuff you just have to learn on the job, and that's where internships and part-time jobs and all of that stuff I think is so helpful because you're right, you don't necessarily know like how to pitch or how to say something or to
compose an email to like a professional email. And I remember learning all of that on that job. And I also had to like write press releases. It was like all over the place when I first started. But when I left that job, I knew how to write a damn good press release. I flexed that like professionalism muscle that I never had to really use before. I mean, customer service I learned like from my parents and working in salons. But that piece of it I didn't really know. And then like having to go to events and having to like keep lists and get back to people and like all the stuff you do as a PR assistant in my case. And it was and pitching and getting on the phone with people. It was all such a great learning experience. And it was fun. I mean, I really relished that time in my life. It was a great experience.
So what'd you do next?
So
I'm guessing, and then at some point you had to think, this is not for me. What do I want to do next?
Well, I did. That happened. So I think that there's like a theme here. I met my husband in New York City during the time I was working for Rodgers and Cowan, and he was an advertising guy. He worked at a big advertising agency in New York, and at this time I had lived in New York, I don't know, 6-7 years, and we met, and you know, like a whirlwind romance. I mean, it was so like that. We were like, we met at this like bar named Hell at like 3 a.m. We got introduced, and it was truly like, you know, it was like love at first sight. Yeah. And we started dating. And then my life shifted. When you're living in New York and you're single, it's very different than when you're living in New York and you're in a relationship. And we kind of like, first we were going out a lot and then we kind of stopped going out. Then it was like dinner and a movie. And then we were like, and we're living in this teeny tiny apartment. And we're like, yeah, I was like, I don't know how much more New York I can do, you know, like this. Because, you know, after a while, New York, like, wears on you and living in a tiny apartment and not having any money. And so I was like, let's move west. Like, let's move to California. And he
– did you have any specific reason for California?
I think – yes. Yes, I should say that. Because when I was working in PR, we would have to come out to L.A. a lot. And so I got – and before that, I'd never been to even been to California because I grew up all the way, you know, in Florida.
Yeah, the other side.
And I remember we came out to L.A. and I was like, ooh, L.A. is really awesome. Why didn't anybody ever tell me about L.A.? So – and, you know, for advertising, it's like New York, L.A., like big cities. So Cameron started looking for a job and I was like – kind of starting to feel like I didn't want to do PR anymore. And I also had, like, the baby bug at that point. I mean, I was, like – and it was, like, maybe, I guess, like, 27. And I was, like – I think that happened maybe young for me. But I was, like, I would just want babies so badly. So at that point in my life, that was, like, the only thing I could focus on was, like, husbands and babies. I mean, I had taken this turn of, like, I don't – you know, that's what I want to be next is that. And luckily, there was Cameron.
So you guys moved to California. You started a family. At what point – I assume that you've left Rodgers and Cowan.
Yep.
And then at what point do you decide to start working again?
So we moved to California and love it. I think LA is like everything I wanted it to be. And we had our kids, and, you know, I was a stay-at-home mom, and I was, you know, so content to be a stay-at-home mom. And by the way, at that point, I was like, that's it for me. I'm going to be a stay-at-home mom. You know, this is a lot of work in and of itself. That's my thing. And so Cameron had a great job in advertising. He was making, like, good money, so I didn't have to work. And after, you know, it's coming. So then we had our second kid. And
I do have a hunch.
So we had our second son 2.5 years later. And then shit got real. And I was like, oh, my God, two kids is so much harder than one kid. And it was like, I remember when Kit, my little one, started crawling. And Grant must have been like all of 3.5. And that's still baby. And they would like go separate directions. And like I'd be at the park and one's going this way and one's going this way. And I was like so stressed out. And, you know, and then it was like after like 5 years of being a stay-at-home mom, I was like, I just felt so like I wasn't doing anything for myself. I was like my whole life was about taking care of the kids. And I loved that. But I remember my husband would come home from work and I'd be like, and like talk his ear off because I hadn't really talked to adults all that much. And it was all like cartoons and parks and kids and toys and diapers. And I was like, I need to like, I might feel like I'm losing my mind. I need to do something else.
So what did you decide to do?
So my best friend and I, my friend Paige, we had met in breastfeeding support group, and we were both kind of having this like itch to do something again. And we actually started what became her business, which was an event planning company called Bash. I know. Isn't that funny?
I didn't know you were a part of that.
Paige and I basically founded. A lot of people don't know because it kind of got glossed over and everything else that was going on in both of our lives. But Paige and I started Bash because it was really because—
Which is an amazing events company.
Yeah, an amazing event planning company. And the reason we started it was because Paige threw me a baby shower for Kit, my younger son. And it was like— It was like the best baby shower ever. It's like had all the like coolest accessories and food and decor. And I was like, dude, you're really good at this. Like, why don't you do this? And she does have such a great knack for interior and design. And so I was like, she was like, yeah, maybe at the time she had like a job that she was kind of doing that she didn't love and taking care of her baby too. And so I was like, I can be like the people person on it and like deal with like the logistics and the clients, customer service piece. And you deal with the like, you know,
the
decor
itself.
And the events. Yeah. And so we started it and, you know, Cameron, my husband, who's creative, kind of helped us with that a little bit and we got it started, but it's an interesting lesson because it wasn't great for us. Like it was not good for our friendship. We were fighting a lot. It wasn't cohesive. We didn't like mesh, you know, and it was like, it was not good. And I remember and she felt it and I felt it and we both knew it. And it was like, how do we untangle ourselves from this? And truly, I remember like sitting in my living room, our babies were like crawling in the floors. And I was like, you know, Paige, I feel like I want to start. She has really curly hair, I should tell you, and always used to make me blow out her hair. And she, of course, knew my past in doing hair for so long. And I was like, I feel like I should start like a mobile blow dry business because I've been honing that craft since I was 12. And I feel like, you know, there's really nowhere for women to go. Like there's the Fantastic Sam's or there's your full service salon, but there's really no place for people to go. And I feel like, you know, if I charge, like, if it's inexpensive enough, I'll go to women while they're—it was, like, moms. I was just thinking moms. I'll go to, our mom friends while their babies are sleeping and, like, charge $40, $220s. Like, very sophisticated business plan here. And she was like, that's a great idea. I was like, it's kind of a good idea, right? And so I remember that night Cameron came home and I told him my idea. He was like, I'll make you a one-page little website. You know, it was such like one of my first marketing lessons because he was like, if the website's cute, people will call you. And so he made me this little web page and the business was called Straight at Home, which I came up with and was very proud of, even though Cameron's always coming up with the cute names. And so I made this website. I posted it on Peachhead, which you probably don't know.
I don't.
You would have if you had a baby 13 years ago like we did because it was before like everybody maybe started to have Blackberries back then, but it wasn't like it is now. And Peachhead was this Yahoo group. Huh. I mean, Yahoo group. I know. I'm really, like, dating myself. It was a Yahoo group called Peachhead, and, like, you had to get accepted into this group. But meanwhile, there was, like, 5,000 moms in L.A. on this thing. And it was like, what's the best diaper cream? What? How do you get your baby to sleep? What's your favorite stroller?
So it was
stroller?
Like a Facebook group before Facebook group.
Yeah. So I posted on this thing saying, hey, guys, I'm, you know, a stay-at-home mom, a longtime hairdresser. I'm thinking of starting a mobile blow dry business, charging $35 or $40. Anybody interested? I got so many emails from that first, like, little post on this Peachhead group.
Because it's a particularly valuable proposition for a mom, because mm-hmm. that means also, like, if you're coming to them, then they don't have to get a babysitter.
Exactly. I can come to you while your baby is napping or whatever. That was, like, my hook. I thought that would be a good
very clever
thing. And I was like, you know, it'd be easy for them to pay me, like, $220s out the door. So I was like, I remember, like, again, being, like, very giddy over the fact that, like, people were emailing me and they're like, yeah, when can you come over? And so I started on this, you know, this little journey, and I went and posted, like, at the Peachhead, I mean, at the pump station, like, a little flyer. So people, and people started calling me, and it was the coolest thing. And you know, from, like, when you're building a business and people start, like, becoming interested in your business and calling you, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe there, it's such a rush. And so I started this business, and I was able to, like, make my own hours. Only really had, like, 3 or 4 hours free a day to do it. But I was, like, running around L.A. I'm sure I may have actually been losing money with all the gas. I don't know. But it wasn't about the money. It wasn't particularly lucrative. But I also think it is what got people, you know, willing to do it, because it was only $40, and I'll come to your house. Like, it's pretty awesome deal. So
– and what year is this?
This is 2000 and, like, late 2008, 2009.
So this is also, I'd like to point out, a radical idea, because I remember when I lived in New York, you could go, like, there was a slightly better version of getting a blowout there than was available in L.A. Like, L.A.
Yeah.
was either, like, you know, like, $80 at a salon or $10 at Fantastic Sam's.
Yeah.
But New York, there was sort of this, like, there were some
Jean-Louis
more.
Jean-Louis David.
Yes. Yes. There were some more, yes. like, mid-level, but it was lame.
Yeah. And it was, like, a French name, so people thought it was better than it was.
Yeah. And, like, you never, it depended on who you got. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. it was a very peculiar situation. But mm-hmm. that, there was nothing like this.
Right.
In
right.
Los Angeles
right.
at all, and, like, with that added luxury of someone coming to you, because this is predates all of the apps by, like, 10 years practically.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, and it was just, like, this, like, whim and a hunch. And so I started this business, and I got very busy very quickly. And really, I mean, I guess that's when the idea for Drybar kind of started percolating, because I was like, huh, I'm having to say no all the time, because I was getting calls left and right. So I kind of came to this crossroads, like, am I going to build my mobile business and bring on other stylists to help go to people's houses, which didn't feel right to me. I felt like, you know, they know me, they love me.
You and that Spidey sense. You're like, this isn't quite right.
This isn't right. Ugh. And so that's when I was like, maybe I need to build a brick and mortar where they come to me instead of me going to them. And so, again, I'm like thinking very small. I'm thinking, like, I could have one, you know, salon, which we don't really ever call Drybar a salon. We never have. I mean, it's kind of people do now, but it's, you know, it was like our shop, and it was just going to be blowouts, and I was going to turn my mobile business clients into, you know, brick and mortar shop clients. And so I went to my brother and my husband, because they were like my two, like, still like my two best friends. And, you know, I said, I think I should turn my mobile business into, like, a brick and mortar. And, you know, I could run the shop, then still pick up the kids from school. And, like, that was going to be my next thing that preceded the you know, straight at home business. And my brother, and I don't know if you've met my husband, but my husband, he's bald, and so is my brother, bald. Meanwhile, I'm like, I want to open this, like, major, this hair concept, you know? And they were, my brother, which is ironic that he grew up with me, was like, so you just want to do blowouts? Like, you know, why can't you blow out your own hair? But Cameron, my husband, of course, knew it, because he knew what my hair looked like when it dried naturally. And he's like, oh, I get it. You know, he got it up from the get-go. And, you know, and I got my brother, like, comfortable with it after a lot of conversations. Cameron, my husband, was, like, immediately sold. He was like, I think this is, like, the next nail salon thing. You get your nails done once a week, but I rarely notice. But when you get a blowout, it's the first thing I notice. So he was like, totally sold. And the fact that he was sold, and he works in advertising, so he thinks, like, everything is a bad idea just by nature. Like, that those guys just, like, they're shooting ideas down all day long. So the fact that he liked it, I was like, that was my first, like, feather in the cap. And then, my brother took a minute to get around to it, and you know, and I needed him to help me with the, like, the business side of it, the financial and all of that. And and I remember him, like, getting, you know, slowly but surely coming around and wanting to be a part of it. And I remember saying to Cameron, I think Michael's going to do this with me. And Cameron being like, no way, he's never going to do it. I'm like, no, I think he thinks it's a good idea and he's going to do it. And, you know, the rest, I guess, is history.
So then you opened your first shop in Brentwood, right?
Yep, in 2010.
In 2010. Did you – I mean, I was an early customer, but I wasn't there on day one. Did you have, like, the marketing and the look and the concept? Was that all fully baked before you started, or did it evolve as you went on?
So I think, you know, part of our success, I think, was that there was a lot of those pieces that we had in place. I mean, so Cameron, the creative, he was like, you know, before we started Dry Bar, he was like working on the branding and the website and all of that stuff. My brother was operating like a real estate marketing company at the time. So he had a lot of experience in marketing and all of that. And I mean, I was really like on the phone with the cosmetology board every day, and I was like hiring stylists. I had stylists coming to my house to blow out my hair. That was the job interview, and making sure they weren't like crazy and they were nice. And so, you know, all those things were kind of coming together. And because of my experience in PR, and my brother actually had like a brief stint in PR too, we knew we were going to have to put some PR behind this. But we also knew, having worked in PR, this is a brand new concept. So like, it's going to get pressed just by virtue of the fact that it's something new to talk about. So I knew that like we probably were going to get some press just because of that. And then my brother is like a great marketer. I mean, I remember before we opened the store, and he was also, I should say, like, we were, like, together going around trying to find locations, and landlords, like, were, like, thought we were out of our minds. Like, what is this? It was also in the middle of a recession.
Right.
And landlords were, like, not even talking to us. And the place in Brentwood that ended up being our first place, and we had to personally guarantee that lease because they were, like, it was such a risk. Once we did sign that lease and we got that location, Michael wanted to put on the window, the first 250 people to sign up to our website get a free blowout. And I was like, are you out of your fucking mind? We can't give away 250 blowouts. And I like was like, no. And I was like freaking out about it. I guess in my mind, it was like those first 250 people are going to be the first 250 people come in the door, which wasn't like that at all. So anyway, we did end up doing that. And it was a great way to get people signing up. And you know, I had my clients from my mobile business who knew about it. And I had this like little community in LA. And so, you know, there was the word of mouth that was certainly spreading. And we did hire a PR firm. We hired Jill Shiat, which you probably know. And, you know, she was very like in with the moms, and that's who we were targeting. And that's who my mobile business was like targeting. So we thought that was going to be our bread and butter, and that's who we should target. So
you didn't realize that it was going to be like every girl's like go-to?
No, not at all. And I also thought it was only going to be for girls with curly hair because like Sarah, my brother's wife, who had straight hair, I was like, she doesn't need Dry Bar. She has that gorgeous straight hair already. But as you know, it turns out girls who have straight hair want curly hair and volume.
Yes.
And vice versa. It's like, we just want what we can't have. So the opportunity was so much bigger than we ever thought, you know? And so the plan was I was going to run that store. You know, Cameron built out the website. My brother was also great friends with our architect, who's still our architect today, Josh Heitler. Michael was like, my little sister has this idea for a hair salon. Would you be interested in helping us build it? And we gave him a little bit of equity, which, again, those are things that I learned along the way, that we didn't have enough money to pay him. So it all like came together. And I've always felt like, you know, we kind of captured lightning in a bottle with all of those like pieces coming together at the right time, with us all living in LA, ironically, at the same time. And, you know, being able to like do this. I mean, it was hard. I mean, Cameron had a full-time job. He's a creative director at an advertising agency. You know, we were working until 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night. Same with Michael, because they weren't ready to give up their full-time jobs. You know, so it was like—
The recession was happening.
And there was a recession. I mean, it was like a crazy time to do this. And I remember people telling me that, like, you know, every business that's been in this space has failed. And there was so much, like, negativity because it was such a new idea. The market was terrible. Women were cutting back on, like, beauty treatments and things like that. But my gut was like, I really think that like women will do this as a part of their routine, you know. And at that time, I was hoping we would do like 30 to 40 blowouts a day, and that would be a great business, which by the way, that would be horrendous. Now, I mean, we're doing like almost 100 plus a day. So it was like, it's just, I mean, so we did not expect it.
At what point from, so you opened the first store, at what point do you feel like, wow, I think we're onto something?
Honestly, I think we felt like that very quickly, like within the first week. And I should also mention, before we opened the store, Daily Candy ran a little like pithy piece on us, like some, you know, some hot new concept is blowing into town. And basically we had that you could book online at Dry Bar before we even opened. And like a week or two before we opened, the Daily Candy piece ran and on people started booking. And I remember my brother and I were at lunch and all of a sudden on our BlackBerry, we started getting all these appointment notifications, which they were trickling in until then. But then it was like, whoosh. And we were like, what the hell is going on? Is there a glitch in the system? And then someone sent us the Daily Candy article. And, you know, in that point, I mean, you remember that. When Daily Candy said something, it was gospel. Like, they always broke new stuff. They were always telling you what the cool new hip thing was. So we were – it was like – that was like the pinnacle to get a thing in Daily Candy.
I mean, it was literally a business changer.
It really was. And my brother had worked for Yahoo years ago when Yahoo was really in its heyday. And he put – Daily Candy on the front page of Yahoo Marketing. And so there was a relationship there, and that really got us, you know, in there. And, you know, everything matters. Don't burn bridges, all that good stuff.
Then at what point did you know that it was time to expand beyond the Brentwood store? Because I always think that there's something so interesting. Scale is so interesting, and it's so scary and exciting. Yeah. At what point did you know, okay, we can do another store? Because you have over 100 now.
Yes. So the Brentwood store was bananas. It was eight chairs. It is eight chairs. I think I had six stylists on that first day. I did not have enough people hired. And we were like, we have got to get more people. And, I mean, I was, like, standing at the first chair doing blowouts and managing. I mean, it was so crazy. I was calling my brother. I'm like, Mike, we've got to get another location. I was there around the clock. And I was like, you have to go find us another location. Figure it out. And so he did. And our second location ended up being in Studio City. That was 6 months later. After,
wow, that was fast.
But it's so funny. I know in retrospect, it was fast. But it wasn't fast at the time. I was like, what are you doing, Michael?
What's taking so
long? Like, I was like, it's been 6 months. It was so crazy. And then West Hollywood proceeded after that, and then Palisades, and then we had a franchise opened in Dallas. And
how do you figure out where to go?
How to go.
Yeah.
Michael knew instinctively, like, if we were going to grow this thing, like, we had to figure out how we were going to grow this thing. And we knew that the stores weren't going to throw off enough capital to just keep opening stores from the profits of the store. So what do? You know, so we raise money. We franchise. He started looking into franchising, which I was not really too keen on. I was like, I don't want to, like, let anybody else, like, ruin this for us. And we ended up franchising our Dallas market to our very close friend, who's, like, our lawyer and helped us so much, one of our lawyers, and his wife, who'd worked in, like, the hotel hospitality industry. So she got it. So that was, like, a very good decision. And then I don't think this is, like, super typical, but we had – you know, angel investors, like clients who were like coming out of woodwork who wanted to invest. So that first, like, I would say like million, 1.5 that we raised was all friends and family. It was like mostly clients, most people I didn't really know who were just like, you know, clients and wanted to invest. And so that was how we initially moved. And then after, like, I think we kind of like just really bootstrapped it until we got to like 10 stores. And that's really when, you know, my brother was like, I think we're going to, if we really want to, like, you know, go big with this, we're going to have to, like, raise institutional money. You know, it was, like, a big, like, year of our lives that were spent just figuring out how to raise more money and really grow and having all these meetings with these, like, guys in suits that did not get it. And so it was a whole journey of figuring out how to get to the next phase, which my brother really fostered and, you know, and made happen. So it's been a wild ride.
So at what point did you decide to start creating products and tools?
So once we did take private equity money, and I mean, now to date, we've raised over almost $60 million. It's like, it's insane. And that was really for the growth of the company to grow and to as many stores as we have. And part of that money was always earmarked for product because I always felt like I wanted to create a product line that was like specifically made for blowouts to make your blowout last longer. And I was using like all these different products from different lines and they were good, but they just didn't work well together. They didn't look good together in the shop. As a blow dry bar, I wanted it to just feel very cohesive. So from the beginning, everything was the same except for the product. So I started, you know, had a couple like not successful tries where I was like trying to do it on my own and working with a consultant. It's really overwhelming to start a product company. I know you know. By the way, do you notice my shirt?
I sure did, girl.
I was like, I'm not going to show up to an interview with Hillary and not be wearing who, what, where. So anyways, it wasn't until we did end up raising money, private equity money, with Castanea. Janet Gerwich was with Castanea and also had founded Laura Mercier Cosmetics and just knew so much about product and how you do it and the labs and all this. And I remember we were still like in the courting phase with Castanea. She said, even if you don't take our money, because we were being approached by a lot of different product companies to do co-branded stuff. And she said, even if you don't take our money, don't do a product line with another product company. Do it on your own. It'll be much better, much more lucrative. You know, you'll have full control, all of that. And so she just was very knowledgeable. And obviously, she built Laura Mercier Cosmetics, which is one of the best, you know, cosmetic brands around. So I really heeded her advice. And we did end up, you know, taking the investment from Castanea. And along with that came Janet. And she really did, like, open doors left and right to, like, the best labs. You know, she introduced us to the CEO of Sephora. Like, she made a lot of, like, progress happen for us and like helped me, like held my hand as we started to build the product business. And that was 4 years ago. And now it's massive.
What was your first product?
Well, we launched with, I think it was like 9 products, and one of them was detox dry shampoo.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. I bet.
And that was like, dry shampoo was such a like obvious thing to me because everybody wanted their blowout to last as long as humanly possible once they get it. So we still have that original formula, which now there's like a whole franchise around detox because it has been so successful, knock on wood, that's, you know, still like such a, it was like the baby and still exists.
So on top of all of this success and building this crazy business and doing all this amazing stuff, you're also starting a podcast called Raising the Bar. What was the inspiration behind that?
You know, I'm sure you're probably in the same boat. I get asked all the time from people, you know, how do you build this business? How did you raise money? How did you know when to hire? How do you balance it? Like, you know, questions are constantly coming into me. I speak on a lot of panels. We've been on panels together.
Sure have.
You know, and I think that over the last year, I feel like I have built up this, like, you know, reservoir of advice, and I've learned so much, and I have all this experience of building a business from, like, you know, things that I don't even think about anymore that are, you know, so valuable. And it was such an amazing, humbling experience building Drybar. And, you know, we're still building. There's still so much more for us to do. But, you know, starting a business from nothing to building it to what it is today is a lot of hard work. I've learned so many lessons, some harder than others along the way. And I think that there's so many people who, you know, want to gain that knowledge and that insight. I felt like there's got to be a way to, like, you know, just talk about
and the share this with the
and
world.
Share it. I mean, there's just so many terms and things that you don't know that you don't know. So I think the show will be such a great way to just kind of give back to the, you know, the business community.
I think that's amazing. So a lot of the women who listen to this podcast are interested in switching careers, but maybe a little bit nervous about making that jump. As someone who has done that a few times, what advice would you give someone?
I feel like, you know, I think that you have to kind of like dig deep and find the like courage first and foremost to say, you know, it's okay if it doesn't work and I fail, because I think that's the hindrance I usually hear from women. Like, I have this great job. I'm a lawyer. I'm making great money. I'm scared to leave my job to start this business because, you know, and obviously there's risk there, and you're making money. You know you're getting your paycheck every week to going from, like, it may not make money. But I think it's, like, figuring out a way to do it, to set yourself up in a situation where you can and, like, you know, start cutting back and start, you know, managing your money differently. I mean, my husband used to, like, I used to be on this, like, app that was, like, a budgeting app, and I could only spend X amount of dollars a week because that was, like, I couldn't live outside of our means. And, you know, I mean, putting yourself on a budget to make sure that you're going to be able to do this business and maybe like having a 6-month plan to get yourself there, putting that money aside so you have that cushion, you know. Or, you know, in my case, it was like going to my brother. I mean, going to friends and family for your business. So I think that's like, you know, the not sexy part of it is like just logistically figuring out how you're going to make that transition. And then beyond that, I think it's also really like making sure that your idea is, or what you want to do really does make sense out in the world, and talking to as many people as you can that you trust, and get like kind of the you know,
test the waters.
And, you know, I mean, for me, starting Drybar was definitely like, you know, a gut feeling that I felt like women really needed.
But also a culmination of everything you'd spent your career doing.
Yeah. And I think it's like, listen to that inner voice, you know, or even if there's like, I feel like this, and you might too, that there's just like, there's so many things that exist. Blowouts existed before Drybar. We just created a much better space and experience around them. And I think that there's like a million businesses out there that somebody might already be doing it, but they may not be doing it well. And you like love this thing, but you're like, ah, it'd be so much better if they did X, Y, and Z. And so you can take that market share. And I think just not being afraid to, I know it sounds so, I'm sure everybody says to just go for it, but I think it's like one of those things that you just have to like find the courage to like take a leap. And I always felt like if Drybar didn't work, like I'm pretty smart, capable person, I would either find a job or I'd figure something else out. Like there's always a way.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because I wish I was the sort of person who could identify white space outside of my own world, but that's not how I personally work. So we keep creating things that kind of are just for us. Mm. But I really believe in that internal voice that says, if I want this, someone else does.
100%.
And I think that we are raised to expect that you need to go to business school or you need this sort of background to be able to figure some of this stuff out. And the thing that no one told me about being an entrepreneur or about business in general is how much of it is common sense.
Oh, my gosh. It's so true.
And you don't need to go to school for common sense. There is a lot of great stuff that you can learn in school. I love education. I'm not knocking it in any way. If your gut's telling you this, if you spend a lot of time in the space, if you personally are interested in something, there's probably something there.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know,
trust yourself.
Yeah, even if you, you know, for me, you know, it was like, it was very much like my brother and my husband, like, you know, for you, I know you and Catherine have been partners forever. And it's like, you find that other person or persons that help you, you know, fill in the holes or the gaps of the things that you don't know. And the things that you need help, and that's okay. I think that's something that people need to recognize too, is that like you can't do everything all the time on your own.
Nor should you.
Nor should you. And just having that person that you implicitly trust to say, is this a good idea or am I out of my mind? You know?
It's always nice to have someone too for that gut check.
Yeah, 100%.
Okay, last question, which is also my favorite question. Mm. If you could take a time machine back in time and go and visit your 19-year-old self, what advice would you give her to young Allie?
I feel like from the way I told my story, it probably sounded like I had a lot of like confidence as I was, you know, meandering through my 20s. But I don't think I had the kind of confidence I have now back then. And I think that really became apparent to me when we had started Drybar, and I was sitting, you know, in board meetings, and I was sitting in these rooms with these like Harvard, you know, men and who had, you know, had these big fancy degrees. And I was like, oh shit, you know, like I feel very uncomfortable and like I'm not smart enough to be sitting here. And it took me a little while to get comfortable in my own skin. And I remember it like it was yesterday, like sitting in board meetings and texting a question to my brother and just being afraid to like ask it in this very impressive group, and him always saying, no, that's a good question, you should ask it. And I think after a few times of that happening, I was like, fuck it, I'm smart. I don't know why I doubted myself, you know? And I think that I got to that point where I was like, no, like I am because I'm not traditionally book smart. I don't have a fancy college degree, but I think that I had a good sense of it. But it took me a long time to feel that and like to feel like I'm just going to speak up and say what I think and not be, you know, scared or timid about it, which, you know, my 19-year-old self, really, I don't think I got that confidence until I was like in my mid-30s. You know, I wish I had that inner voice that took a long time to come out when I was younger.
Well, I'm glad that it's here now. That was Drybar founder Allie Webb.
If you like today's show, please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate us and review us. Also, word of mouth is so important. So if you don't mind sharing that you've been listening to us, maybe put us in your Instagram stories. Maybe tag me. You can tag my domain. Help us get the word out. It means the world to me, and I would really appreciate it. As always, I'd love to know who you'd like to hear from on this show, so send in your requests either via email to secondlife@mydomain.com, or you can just DM me on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. Thank you for listening to this episode of Second Life. For more interviews with inspiring women like Allie, head on over to mydomain.com, where we have so many more stories for you to peruse, like tons. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life by MyDomain.com.